We are reading a few stories from Abraham's life these few weeks. The way stories work, I said last week, is that they invite us to walk in someone else's shoes, to enter someone else's experience, and to see how their thinking and actions might enlarge our points of view and our sense of possibilities. So at the onset, I'm just going to tell you, I have a hard time doing that with today's story. When Abraham is asked to take a life in the name of religion, something so awful to us and criminal, even though I suppose it was completely normal in Abraham's time. There's a town in northern China, a few hundred kilometers from the Mongolian border. A section of the Great Wall runs through this town, and the people there always thought that these rock piles in town were the debris field left over from when they built the wall. But when archaeologists dug into the piles, they were surprised to discover an ancient fortress city that dates back to Abraham's time, complete with a 4,300-year-old pyramid, 2,000 years older than anything in recorded Chinese history. But what was even more shocking was to find 80 skulls in six pits under one of the foundations, mostly of young girls, probably prisoners of war. There was an ancient people in China that practiced human sacrifices. And there are pits like these all over the world, some as recent as 500 years ago, like one in Peru of the Shamu people, 269 children between 5 and 14 and 3 adults. This is the worst one they have ever found so far. And they think that it was because it was a bad El Nino year. The offering was to coax the gods to stop the rain. So the Shamu offer their gods the most valuable thing they have, their children. An anthropologist describes the cost of this practice. You're sacrificing the future and all that potential, she says. All the energy and effort that's gone into continuing your family, continuing your society into the future, you're taking that away when you take a child. This is Abraham's world. Can you imagine trading away your children's life for any reason? Even for what one historian calls supernatural assistance. I cannot. In today's story, the storyteller says God comes to Abraham, asks him to offer Isaac up as a human sacrifice, and Abraham seemingly complies without any protest. In the last minute, God stops him and provides an animal alternative. I guess the most natural thing for us is to read stories from Abraham's life and try to imagine the stories as Abraham because we think he's the star of the story. But if this is the storyteller's intention, then he really hasn't given us much to go on about what Abraham is thinking and feeling. Compare this story with Job's story about Job grappling with losses. That story describes Job's actions and reactions and turmoil in detail. This story is strangely and disturbingly matter of fact about the whole thing, completely absent of any emotional engagement from Abraham. Why wasn't Abraham more distressed and troubled, right? God seemingly wants him to kill his son Isaac, his only son, the impossible baby he waited 25 years for God to gift him, when his wife Sarah was well past the age when humans stopped making babies. If Abraham was bothered by God's requests, the storyteller skips all of that. Abraham's story is the unlikely origin story of ancient Israel. When 4,000 years ago, God approached a childless old man and made him the offer of his dream. God promised Abraham he would father a nation beginning with the birth of a son. And this divine promise rested entirely on Isaac growing up to have children of his own. So it is inconceivable, right, that having raised Isaac to 17 or 27, we don't quite know, that God would ask Abraham to kill his important son in a religious ritual just because God said so. And Abraham just obeys without a word of protest. Now, our modern Bibles call this story the testing of Abraham, because it says in verse 1 that God tested Abraham. This two makes us think Abraham is the star of the story. He's asked to do a hard thing to kill the love of his life, and God sits in the back to see if Abraham would do it. For us, a test is something we do so that the one doing the test can find out something about the one being tested. Or the one being tested needs to prove something to the tester, like a driving test. It's the government trying to find out if someone can operate a vehicle safely. And it's up to the one taking the test to prove it, to get their license. If we understand the story this way, focus on Abraham as the star of the story, then God is the one giving the test, of course. And Abraham is the one who supposedly needs to prove himself, something of his unwavering trust or his loyalty, like a good soldier obeying a commander without question. If this is the point of the story, then it's a horror story. There's not a lot of good news here, that we should be very frightened of God, who at any given time might just call on us to his office to lay out before him our treasures so he can break a few things just to test our love and loyalty. Is this why we suffer losses then? Because God wants to see how we react? Somebody told me during the week that there's a couple right now whose seven-year-old son is in the children's hospital fighting for his life. What are his parents supposed to do with this story? How are they supposed to pray in this scary, heartbreaking time of their life? And when they pray, can they trust God to love their son as much as they do? So for people who think Abraham is the star of the story, the hero, they talk about Abraham's silence as the gold standard of faith, that he doesn't argue, but just keeps his suffering quietly to himself, never raising a complaint about how terrible that all is in the moment when nothing makes sense. The moral of the story is then we should aspire to that kind of trust and obedience, accepting whatever God dishes out without raising a peep of protest. But any counselor will tell you, suffering silently and alone is hardly healthy. To go through hard times this way will lead to mental illness. I heard this in a Korean drama. The truly lonely people are the ones who can't even say they are lonely. There's no evidence that being passive and quiet is somehow a more biblical way to suffer when there are so many complaining prayers in the Psalms. And so many people in the Bible who argue with God and God seems perfectly happy to engage and argue back. And I find it hard to accept that God needs to rip things from us just to see if we would still trust him. For one thing, God cannot be that insecure. For another thing, what could God possibly need to find out about Abraham or us that he doesn't already know? And for yet another thing, I don't know about you, I for one need things to make sense, at least as far as I have enough information to go on. This so-called test makes no sense to me. It is unreasonable and too hard and too cruel. I cannot do what Abraham did in a million years. And I'm uncomfortable of reading the story as a casual metaphor for our willingness to offer up to God our things, like a career or a dream or a relationship. Because as hard as it may be to let go of things we love, it's not murder. Giving up these things would hurt us, but at least we can sort of imagine a reason for it. In fact, when I set aside my engineering career to pastor, it never felt for a second like a sacrifice. I wasn't forced to do it to prove anything. I chose to do it, and I was grateful for the opportunity. If this story is about what Abraham does or does not do, if this is a test of Abraham, then what new things do we learn about him in the end? By the start of the story, we already know that Abraham is quite willing to take leaps of faith when God asks, like to pack up and move to destination unknown. He's quite willing to challenge God and argue. More than once, he called God out on how it's taking too long for God to give him that son he was promised. Or when he heard God say that God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah for being such a hub of mean and cruel people, and Abraham argued and got God to agree to save the town if there was still just 10 good people there. So if Abraham argued for the life of strangers in Sodom, why would he keep silent when it came to the life of his own precious son? Now, just because the storyteller doesn't say it doesn't mean it didn't happen. Omission is never evidence that there was not more to the story. And in fact, precisely because the storyteller doesn't describe the agony that Abraham went through, the agony we expect any dad to go through, perhaps it's the clue that the story is actually not about Abraham. He's not the star of the story. And that's and whether it was hard or easy for him doesn't have any bearing on the story that the storyteller wants to tell. What if the storyteller skips Abraham's side of the story so we wouldn't be distracted from the actual point of the story, which is God's pressing desire to outlaw this despicable practice for the new alternative society God is creating with Abraham? So what if God is the star of the story? Then doesn't the story tell us the opposite about God, that instead of being callous about Isaac's life, or that he's even jealous of Abraham's love of his son, God actually loved Isaac as much as Abraham loved Isaac? That God loves your children as much as you love your children. And that's why God stopped Abraham and then proceeded to outlaw this practice for all future generations. If this story is about a test of someone, then the new thing we learn, it's about God, something the world had never known before this moment. That in a world of many gods that demanded to be fed and kept the peace with human sacrifices, there was one who was as horrified with the practice as we are, who would gladly accept a lamb chop off our dinner plate as a sufficient gift. This new thing Abraham learned about God, we take for granted, because it is no longer an acceptable thing to do. So what God did with Abraham worked. If this is really a test, and it turns out to be a test of God, that perhaps that's the point of the story, and why this story was so important to the Jewish people, that they were the first people to outlaw human sacrifices. And it happened at this moment, and how the Jewish people came to reject all other gods and gave their exclusive allegiance to this one. Now, I was happy to learn that when I looked up the Hebrew word for test, nisa, that while it is translated most of the time as test, it also at times means venture, like joint venture and adventure. So maybe instead of a test of Abraham's faith, maybe this story is about a venture in his friendship with God. What if God comes to Abraham one day and said, there's a thing I've been wanting to do to save the babies and the young men and women of the world from a senseless religious ritual, and I need your help with this. Do you trust me enough to bring Isaac, the love of your life, so we can get this done together? No harm will come to Isaac because I love Isaac as much as you love Isaac. There's no way to know how much details Abraham knew ahead of time about this adventure. Like when Isaac asked, carrying all the firewood and tools, did we forget to bring an animal for the offering to God? And Abraham says, God will provide a sacrifice. What was he saying? Is this simply Abraham lying to Isaac? Or maybe he means exactly what he said, that he knew more than what the storyteller is telling us, and he just blew the surprise ending to the story. Regardless, God will provide is what the storyteller wants people of all generations to remember, and remember to pass on to their kids that God hates human sacrifices. And they must remember this for the sake of young men and women in case some crackpot shows up suggesting the way to ward off bad luck or to stop volcano from blowing or to make rain is to offer someone's son or daughter to the gods on an altar. What if the story is better titled God and Abraham's Venture on Mount Moriah? A moment when Abraham was willing to do something important with God, to go on an adventure together to accomplish something for the greater good. And if Abraham didn't know exactly what God was going to do, perhaps by now Abraham had gone through enough with God to say, all right, let's see how this goes. Maybe he thought to himself, if God needed a trusting partner to get this thing done, I'm in. Because his relationship with God was the kind of friendship that when your friend calls, you would drop what you're doing and show up to help with the thing your friend needs. A friend posted this line from a movie: friendship means little when it's convenient. What God asked of Abraham may have been at best inconvenient and at worst scary, but Abraham was game and did a great service for civilization because he said yes. So good for Abraham. But if it's me, forget about it. A few years ago, I figured out that fear and adventure feels the same to me. Same elevated heart rate and sweaty palms. And I'm just going to admit that I don't have much stomach for daredeviling. I'm too much of a coward. I find life challenging enough without me going looking for more daring do. I don't know if people still do this, but there used to be Christians who brought out poisonous snakes during the church service, so worshipers were offered a chance to test their faith by handling the snakes. I think a few years ago, a pastor in Texas died from the snake bites. It's a form of spiritual bungee jumping. If it's not snakes, it's something else. Attempting something crazy for God to prove our faith to God and get an adrenaline rush into our spiritual lives. If we think Abraham is the gold standard of superhero faith, then we're going to conclude that we need to impress God with spiritual heroics. I remember the people I went singing with warning us about coming home and trying to maintain the short-term mission's spiritual high. The trick, they told us, is to go back home to learn to be faithful in the boring routines of real everyday life. I don't think God needs us to prove anything to him that he doesn't already know. Just like marriage is not about constantly doing over-the-top things to prove your love to each other, but it's about staying faithful in the ordinary day-to-day, hanging in to work through hard things together. And besides, we're all different. The excitement bungee people get from jumping off a bridge, some of us would get from skipping a step on a staircase. I feel quite comfortable in saying that God is very considerate of my limitations, my hang-ups, and my particular wiring as a person. God has faith adventures of all shapes and sizes perfectly catered to our individual quirks. And he never pits one of his children against another for sport. He would never toy with my feelings for no good reason. I can trust him to care about the things and people most important to me because I need him to. So honestly, if God comes to me and asks for my firstborn son, I would argue, wouldn't you? I would say, come on, God, really? You're not making sense. This is a prank, right? But how about this? Here's a counteroffer. How about I give you this nice leg of lamb I just picked up I was going to have for dinner? You can have it. It's my gift to you, and maybe you can use it to come up with a plan B to get done whatever you're wanting to. And maybe God would smile and let out a knowing laugh. You got me. I can't pull a fast one on you. It's what I was going to do in the last minute anyways, but you beat me to the punchline. I knew you would because it's so you. I hope that would be okay too, that there's room for negotiation, just like God did with Abraham over Sodom. I hope so. And I hope to get to the same place with God as Abraham did in the end, in whatever sense he's a model of faithfulness. That God would find me just as faithful and loyal, as faithful as I can be to God being the person I am, without having to compare myself to someone else. Ever since Abraham said yes to friendship with God, it's been one spiritual adventure after another, and that's how he came to know God as the rock and anchor in his life. But it's not because of what Abraham did or did not do. That is because of what God did and did not do. I have my own adventures with God, my own stories, and you have yours, I'm sure. Hard things you survived and monsters you're wrestling with right now. In the end, we all forge our own paths with God with the hope that by being authentically who we are, we all get to the same place in our relationship with God, that we come to know the same God who is for us, who loves us, and wants all of us to live full lives as his children and as a person who spreads love and blessing in the world. Not because we have to all act and think and be the same, but because God is the same and loves us the same. Because as Paul says, God does not show favoritism. He favors all of us with the same extravagant love and grace. So, what does this story bring up for you about your life? The God who enlisted Abraham's assistance to outlaw human sacrifices. What kind of venture and adventure have you had with him? What adventure are you on in this moment? Or is there one you see coming around the corner that's going to require you to lean into him harder? Because getting through it all depends less on what you can do, but what God can do through you and in you and with you. Have you come to learn that he cares about you and what you care about? And he knows you and your limits. And he has done some important things, blessing things together with you because you said yes when he asked. The Jewish people called this story the binding of Isaac because Abraham had to tie Isaac up at the crucial moment. And Isaac, who was old enough to carry a large quantity of firewood, and Isaac, who was at this point old enough to fight back. But he does not. He trusts his dad to play along with the whole venture, his dad, whatever his dad cooked up with God. I wonder if at any moment he felt let down by his dad. I'm going to guess that most of the victims of human sacrifice didn't volunteer for the job. So they have been where Isaac was, tied up and on the altar, completely helpless because of decisions other people made, and just at the mercy of the one holding the knife. The fact that God intervened is good news for all of us in helpless situations. That when everyone lets us down, we can count on God to be on our side. We will always have our questions about why God doesn't come to our rescue in the way we ask, even though we don't know why he allows awful things to happen in this life, but it's not because he doesn't care about us. We matter to God, and he has our souls safely in his hands. There's a rabbi who says the binding of Isaac's story is one of three events that forms the identity of the modern Jewish person. During the Holocaust, the Jewish people wrestled with this story. They were asked tough questions of God in their diaries and their poetry. I imagine many of the parents must have wondered where God was in the moments when some Nazi soldier in a concentration camp pulled their Isaacs from their hands, and they never saw their children again. But despite all the unanswered questions about why God allowed the Holocaust, perhaps some found solace in Isaac's story that despite Hitler saying that he was on mission for God, God was not on the side of Hitler. So they could entrust their children's souls to God because God loved their children as much as they loved their children. This is a poem by Amir Gilboa called Isaac. Early in the morning, the sun, S-U-N, took a walk in the forest together with me and with Father and my right hand and his left. Like lightning, a knife flamed between the trees. And I fear so, the terror of my eyes facing blood on the leaves. Father, hurry and save Isaac, and no one will be missing at lunchtime. It is I who am being slaughtered, my son, and my blood is already on the leaves. And the father's voice was stifled and his face pale. And I wanted to cry out, writhing not to believe and tearing open the eyes. And I woke up. And bloodless was my right hand. Here's a prayer by Kate Bowler called A Blessing for the Courage to Try. Bless you, faced with the impossible. You who do not take your eyes away from what threatens to swallow you whole. You who stare down reality though your heart quickens. You whom action comes swiftly as you chart the next step. Or bulldoze a new path yourself. You know how to turn hope into action, and bless you when you've come to the end of what is possible. find the courage to live there too. Bless are we who are learning how to hope, how to let go, when to act, and when to stop, balancing the impossibility of so much love and so much to fear together. Amen.